On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No one knows what the U.S. Supreme Court will finally decide on the constitutionality of the health care reform before the nine justices this week. But yesterday sounded like a rough day for the reform, in particular for the individual mandate to buy health insurance, the crux of the reform legislation. It is a fork in the road for the country. This hour On Point, the High Court and the future of health care. You can join the conversation. Were you listening? Is the mandate really a new high watermark in government power? Is it social insurance like we've had since the New Deal? Did it sound like it's going down? Should it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We do not often do back-to-back days on the same subject, but this is historic. It's enormous. It will have big implications, enormous implications, whichever way the court goes here. And there are a lot of nuances within that path. With us today from Washington is Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University, legal affairs editor at The New Republic, author of The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks for being here today.
Good to be here.
Also with us from Urbana, Illinois, is Kurt Lash, professor of law and director of the program on constitutional theory, history, and law at the University of Illinois, author of The Lost History of the Ninth Amendment. Kurt Lash, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
And with me in the studio is David Cutler, professor of applied economics at Harvard. He was senior healthcare advisor to President Obama's 2008 campaign and helped design the Obama healthcare reforms. The New Republic has called him the original architect of what became the Affordable Care Act. David Cutler, welcome back to On Point.
Pleasure to be with you.
Let's listen to just one of the justices here for a moment, but a very important one, seen by many as the swing vote, a swing vote in how the court may go here. Here was Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy yesterday saying that the individual mandate is breaking new territory in government power.
Here the government is saying that the federal government has a duty to tell the individual citizen that it must act. And that is different from what we have in previous cases.
Well,
that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
There is a big claim. Changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way. Jeffrey Rosen, what did you hear writ large in yesterday's arguments and court questioning over the heart of the health care reform?
Well, it is true that Justice Kennedy alarmed many supporters of the mandate by suggesting that it had changed the relationship of the citizen to the federal government. But on the other hand, at the end of the argument, Kennedy asked an equally tough question of the challenger's lawyer. He said the crux of the government's argument is that young people are essentially free riding on the system and that everyone is going to need health care, and I'm struck by that argument. So I wouldn't read too much into either question. He certainly gave both sides a hard time, and really, it is difficult to predict what the court will do based on oral argument. The instant reaction was that Kennedy and Roberts were in play, but Scalia and Alito and Thomas were not. It really is too soon to say that. All we can say from yesterday's remarkable, invigorating, engaging argument is that both sides got an extremely close scrutiny, and the justices are certainly signaled their interest in the case.
Let's hear that other side, the kind of bracketing from Justice Kennedy. He started or began earlier talking about a fundamental change in relationship of government and individual here, but by the end, he was also referring, and this was kind of the lifeline for supporters of the reform, looking for something that might say they've got at least five votes here, that health care is different, something unique about health care and insurance markets that might allow for them to be regulated differently than other markets. Here's Justice Kennedy again.
The government tells us that's because the insurance market is unique, and in the next case it'll say the next market is unique. But I think it is true that if most questions in life are matters of degree, in the insurance and health care world, both markets stipulate two markets. The young person who's uninsured is uniquely, proximately, very close to affecting the rates of insurance and the cost of providing medical care in a way that is not true in other industries. That's my concern in the case.
That word, unique, uniquely, was focused on and quickly by supporters of the reform throughout the day yesterday, or the couple of hours of argumentation and questioning. There was a lot of suggestion that this was not so unique, that this questions about whether this was comparable to ordering people to buy broccoli or cell phones or burial insurance. Kurt Lash, what did you hear, broad stroke, in the court's questioning yesterday?
Well, I think that Jeff is absolutely right. It shows an engaged court, one that believes there are serious and complicated issues here. And so, you know, in some ways, that's a little bit of a victory to challengers to the act who, you know, as of a year ago, I think most commentators were thinking that this would be an easy case. Maybe there might be one vote in the Supreme Court to strike down the act, but that this was a fairly obvious exercise of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And I think what you saw yesterday is, in fact, you have a court that's divided and likely five justices who are deeply concerned about the implications of this act. I agree with Jeff. It's perhaps more likely that the votes against the act might be Justices Thomas, Alito, and Scalia. You at least get Alito and Scalia asking very vigorous and critical questions during oral argument. But I also think that the arguments yesterday revealed both the Chief Justice Roberts and obviously Justice Kennedy also have very serious questions about the implications for federal power if this is upheld. And so, yeah, I would agree that their votes are in play. And surprisingly, I think we find ourselves today quite unsure whether or not the court is going to make the dramatic move and strike down the act.
With those votes in play, in effect, the heart of the act is in play. David Cutler, you were there at the creation, there from the beginning of thinking about these reforms and helping design them. Did you see it going down in flames yesterday?
I think it's going to depend a lot on what today's discussion is, in the sense that one of the
severance and whether things can be broken out, broken apart and still implemented even without that, potentially without the individual mandate.
That's correct. So there are really three positions the court could take, assuming they decide to strike down the individual mandate. One would be the mandate goes, but everything else in the bill stays, in which case you would then, Congress would need to decide if it wanted, what it wanted to do as a result of that. Second is the court could strike down the mandate and also strike down the very, very popular insurance reforms, the reforms that say insurers are not allowed to cherry pick people, they can't turn away sick people and cover only healthy people. Mm-hmm. And the government has taken the position that if the court strikes down the mandate, it needs to strike those down as well.
Mm-hmm. Because they can't pay for those things without having everybody in the pool.
Because you need everybody covered in order for that to occur. Or third, the court could go the way that the states have argued, in the way that one court ruled, which is that if it strikes down the mandate, it has to strike down the entire law. That's obviously the most cataclysmic. That puts everything back at square one. And it's not clear at all what would happen at that point.
Wouldn't striking down the mandate, in effect, take down most of the law? Because you can't have the parts that we've focused on. It's a big law. But if you can't change who and how insurers insure, doesn't that really rob the guts of the law?
There's
you can't afford to pay for it via the mandate.
There's a bit of a debate about how much of the coverage expansions could still survive. So, for example, with the very generous subsidies that are in the law, you'd still get a number of people to buy. Whether that led to the whole thing unraveling or to just a less happy place is something that there's some debate about. What Congress concluded, which based on a lot of testimony, is that they didn't want to take the chance as to what would happen if they didn't have the mandate, which is a perfectly substantively good economic argument to decide they want to do that. But you would still have, unless they throw out the subsidies, you would still have subsidies. And then there's a question as to whether the insurance regulations would be there or not, depending what the court decides.
I want to come back and look at that. Jeffrey Rosen, for many Americans, this was an unusual opportunity to see the court listen to it in such detail so closely and certainly on such a highly charged issue. And this may seem like a dumb question, but what did you think of the quality of the questioning? I mean, some of the questions seemed to me kind of deliberately obtuse, but maybe not.
questions about broccoli and whether this was the same as buying cell phones and whether this is the same as buying burial insurance. Is that those kind of broad questions? Is that how the court normally approaches a case, or were they sort of were they deaf to the differences of the healthcare market, or am I missing something?
No, it may just be unfamiliarity with the peculiar style of the court, but I think they do ask these sort of questions in ordinary cases. But what was remarkable about yesterday's argument was the combination of the broad hypotheticals you're talking about, mm-hmm. can you force people to buy insurance for burials, and also the extraordinarily technical discussions of whether or not the suit could go forward the day earlier and parsing details of federal statutes. I thought it was just a remarkably engaged court. It was, the atmosphere was electric because they knew the issues so well. And I mean, there are many aspects of the oral argument that one might note or object to. I was struck by how much of it was consumed with policy arguments. Justice Breyer got impatient at one point because Justice Roberts was noting a bunch of exceptions that the law made for pregnant women and so forth. And he said, well, you may not like the law as a policy matter, but that shouldn't have anything to do with the constitutionality. But the fact that those hypotheticals about broccoli and cell phones struck me not as obtuse or simple-minded, but really pressing the lawyers to identify what the conservatives felt was the heart of the matter. Is there any limit to Congress's power? And the fact that General Verrilli, for the government, was really unable to identify a limit, and again, Justice Breyer jumped in impatiently at one point and said, well, you are saying that there's a limit. Congress can't regulate purely local activity that's non-economic. That's your limit, isn't it? But the fact that the general wasn't able to say, well, yes, Congress could regulate burial if there was a national market for burials that the government occupied.
Jeffrey Rosen, hold the thought there. We'll come right back to it. Jeffrey Rosen, Kurt Lash, David Cutler, we're looking at health care and the Constitution out of yesterday's arguments before the Supreme Court. You can join us. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about health care and the Constitution on the final day today of arguments before the Supreme Court on the fate of the Obama health care reforms. You can join the conversation. Did you hear the hard questioning from the justices yesterday on the reform, on the individual mandate to have health insurance? Were you thinking the mandate's going down? These reforms are in trouble. Were the conservative justices on the right track? Is the individual mandate like ordering people to buy broccoli, buy burial insurance, buy a cell phone? And would the mandate mean a new relationship between government and citizen? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Kurt Lash is with us from the University of Illinois, professor of law there. Jeffrey Rosen from George Washington University joins us from Washington. David Cutler helped design the health care reforms, was senior advisor on health care to candidate Barack Obama in 2008. He's with me in the studio. Let's listen to a little of the back and forth, and then we'll dive in here again. Now, here's Justice Scalia, and he's asking the Obama administration's Solicitor General, this is David Verrilli, whether his argument couldn't lead to any and all markets for all kinds of things you might purchase being regulated in the same or similar way. When Verrilli responded that healthcare is unique and that nearly everyone is already in the market or will be, Chief Justice Roberts came in, comparing the situation to the market for maybe emergency services or even cell phones.
If I'm in any market at all, my failure to purchase something in that market subjects me to regulation.
No, that's not our position at all, Justice Scalia. In the healthcare market, the healthcare market is characterized by the fact that, aside from the few groups that Congress chose to exempt from the minimum coverage requirement, those who for religious reasons don't participate, those who are incarcerated, Indian tribes, virtually everybody else is either in that market or will be in that market. And the distinguishing feature of that is that people cannot generally control when they enter that market or what they need when they enter that market.
The same, it seems to me, would be true, say, for the market in emergency services, police, fire, ambulance, roadside assistance, whatever. You don't know when you're going to need it. You're not sure that you will. But the same is true for health care. You don't know if you're going to need a heart transplant or if you ever will. So there's a market there. In some extent, we all participate in it. So can the government require you to buy a cell phone because that would facilitate responding when you need emergency services? You can just dial 911 no matter where you are.
That was Justice Scalia, then Solicitor General Verrilli, and then Chief Justice Roberts. Jeffrey Rosen, jump in here with us. This issue of whether the health care market is unique seemed critical yesterday, Justice Kennedy pointing at it as the thing that might turn him toward support of this legislation. He didn't put it quite that way, but that's the inference. What about the arguments that you heard before the court yesterday about whether or not this is a unique market?
Yes, this seemed crucial because the conservative justices were convinced that you couldn't create commerce, you could only regulate it.
Mm-hmm.
And the liberal justices responded, there's no commerce being created here because everyone is going to need health care at some point of their lives. The question is just whether you can make them pay when they enter the emergency room, which everyone conceded that they could, or whether you can act preemptively to make people require buy health care before you need it. And that led to a long discussion of whether the government before has ever made people buy things in advance. And that was what led to the debate about whether the healthcare market is different than the market for burial and cell phones and so forth. But I think Justice Breyer really got to the heart of the matter when he said, well, yes, the government could force you to buy burial plots if the entire burial industry were as regulated as the healthcare market is. And that was really a crux of the debate.
Kurt Lash, what about we heard Justice Ginsburg come in and say, well, this isn't so different. We've got Social Security. Is this so different from other social insurance programs, Social Security, Medicare? Kurt Lash?
Well, that's right. One of the questions is whether or not, you know, programs that have long been considered constitutional and within Congress's commerce powers really set a precedent, really. This particular program is no different from these longstanding and generally well-accepted government programs. But really, that goes to how you conceptualize the case, because there are two key issues that the court was struggling with. One, are we dealing, again, just in terms of conceptualizing what's going on, is this a situation where the government is forcing people into a market that they've not chosen to enter? Or is this a situation where people are already in the market and this is a run-of-the-mill exercise of Congress's power to regulate those participants who are already in the market? Now, depending upon how you conceptualize it, there then comes a second line of issues. Well, if that's the proper concept for this case, what are the limiting principles? How far can they take this power? What are the conditions in which they can force people into the market? Or if you think they are already participants in the market, does that mean that what other markets are we participating in? Is there any end to Congress's likely conception of what people are choosing to not buy today and therefore might need some type of congressional requirement?
But wasn't the government's argument, if I may, excuse me, but that we are, as humans, all in the market? It's essentially lifelong. We are vulnerable, mortal creatures. Our health is vulnerable to disease and injury. And so whether we participate or not, whether we chip in or not, we're all in the market because when the bus hits us, we're going to the hospital. The hospital's going to do the work and somebody's going to pay.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, what Mr. Carvin then speaks about later on in response to Breyer's suggestion that once we are born, we are now participants in a market simply by virtue of being alive. Carvin's response to that was, well, then our lives are fully subject to government regulation, cradle to grave. And although Justice Breyer would be perfectly happy to have a broad conception of human beings in this living soup of market activity, other justices on the court are going to be quite concerned with that. And I'm not so sure that Justice Kennedy bought in to the idea that we are always and everywhere participants in the market. I think he framed his opening question along the lines of his conception that people were really being forced into the market, and that would require some type of extraordinary justification.
Jeffrey Rosen, what about the suggestion that we are all in the market, in a unique market here, because we are all mortal? We're all frail flesh and therefore lifelong vulnerable. And if we're going to guarantee treatment to people, which we essentially do, we're all there. And that's different from deciding whether I'll have a cell phone or broccoli for lunch.
Well, I'm persuaded by the distinction, but I think whether you're persuaded or not, the court traditionally has been deferential to the political branches about these questions. Whether we are indeed in the market or not is really not a question that judges have any special ability to decide. And that's why one interesting case that was brooding behind the argument and was mentioned a couple times mm-hmm. was the Lochner case. For conservatives, this is the root of all constitutional evil. It was the activism that led the court to strike down minimum wage and maximum hour laws in the progressive era. And everyone agrees on the court that Lochner is bad. But in a really remarkable twist, Chief Justice Roberts seemed to be turning Lochner on his head. And he said, for us to fail to strike down health care, because it would require us to distinguish among different kinds of market activity, would be an example of judicial activism. So it's possible that the judges, far from feeling that they should defer to the political branches in the face of economic contestability, might do the opposite and say, because we're afraid that there are no limits to this principle, we're going to strike down the mandate.
Of course, this then goes to the issue of whether or not the legislative and executive branch can effectively grapple with huge national problems when they're just as big as healthcare. Here's an exchange where Justice Alito first presses the Solicitor General Verrilli on how the individual mandate would force people to pay for services that they might not consume. You'll hear Justice Alito, then Verrilli, and then Justice Ginsburg coming in saying, look, there's a basic principle here that's behind all insurance.
Isn't it the case that what this mandate is really doing is not requiring the people who are subject to it to pay for the services that they are going to consume? It is requiring them to subsidize services that will be received by somebody else.
No, I think that — I mean, I do think that's what the respondents argue. It's just not right. I think it really gets to a fundamental problem with
their argument. If you're going to have insurance, that's how insurance works.
There's Justice Alito, then Solicitor General Verrilli, then Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. If you're going to have insurance, that's how insurance works. Jeffrey Rosen, Kurt Lash, David Cutler, stand by. Let me go to our listeners. John in Kingston, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Morning. I'd like to comment on the difference between broccoli and health care. If someone who's hungry shows up at my doorstep, I have no obligation to feed him. But if a dying person or sick person shows up at the hospital, there is a mandate to provide service to that person. Okay, and personally, I'm sick of paying for people who don't have the foresight to know that they're going to be in that situation at some point. Okay, we all pay already. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like broccoli. You don't want to pay anymore. This kind of lines up with the government argument. David Cutler, Kurt, Jeffrey, did I hear for a moment yesterday the suggestion that maybe we shouldn't have that commitment to serving whoever shows up wounded or sick? Kurt, Jeffrey, did you hear that?
Well, that was, I think you heard some of that from Scalia and mm-hmm. some from Justice Alito. And then I think also Mr. Carbon made points along those lines. I think what was going on at that point was addressing the so-called bootstrapping argument, that if the problem in this particular case is cost shifting.
Cost shifting from those who have insurance, onto those who have insurance, when uninsured come in and aren't insured to pay for their treatment. Yeah,
it's exactly right. Yeah. And the fact when the uninsured then have some type of medical crisis, medical emergency, and they go to the emergency room, they are going to pass those costs on to other people, and that ultimately can affect insurance rates and just generally is going to affect third parties. One of the responses to that is that it's a societal decision to fund those people, to provide health care for them when they come to the emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. And so it's a burden. It's a cost that society has brought on itself. And so, therefore, it's complicated whether or not you can actually accuse the individual as shifting that cost, whereas it seems to be the individual along with society's decision that individual should be cared for whenever they show up.
Jeffrey, is there any indication here that commitment should change instead of the insurance policy changing?
No, I think that, as Kurt says, this was in the context of trying to figure out at what point could the government make people pay. And then several justices were sympathetic to the caller's suggestion. Why should everyone else have to subsidize emergency room care? but they all agreed that you could actually make someone get insurance at the moment that they entered the emergency room. I think that was the point of the discussion. And then it became a timing issue about granted the ability to coerce insurance at the time healthcare was consumed. Why not mandate it earlier so that costs would be lowered for everyone?
David Cutler, this gets back to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's observation about how insurance works. I mean, it doesn't work when you buy it at the moment that you're injured and bloody and lying in the emergency room. It would be unattainably expensive.
That's correct. And one of the things that the justices were not grappling with, which they ought to have grappled with, is the time period in which you're thinking about this. As if you think about it, on, say, for a year, I may not get sick this year. Hopefully I will not, but at some point over my lifetime I will. And to talk about whether the transfer is to or from me this year is in some sense not meaningful. The really meaningful question is, over a lifetime, how should we go about paying for this? That's the whole idea of private insurance and social insurance, which is that at some periods of time you're going to pay and not use the services, and at other periods of time you will use many more services than you've paid for that year.
We're looking at the historic argument before the Supreme Court this week, passionate kind of exchanges yesterday, a lot of skepticism there, and where all this may go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom, many times, or at least on several occasions, President Obama has said that he is interested in fundamentally changing America. I think this medical reform bill is a vast expansion of government power. It gives the government a justification to be intimately involved with our daily lives, whether we smoke, what we eat, how much exercise we take. I heard John Dean, a former presidential candidate, governor of Vermont, in Cambridge say that he would be in favor of mandatory physical examinations.
I mean, Howard Dean.
Test to see if you're, you know, you've got nicotine in your blood or, you know, what your BMI is. So I certainly hope the Supreme Court sees this for what it is a vast intrusion on the individual American citizen.
Let me ask you, Steve, I mean, you talk about fundamental change here, but we have changed before. We had big changes during the New Deal. We came up with Social Security. We've got a big problem on the health care front. I mean, are we finished changing? Is that your view here, or is this just a particularly unacceptable change to you?
Tom, when it comes to medical treatment, over and over again, bodies like the Congressional Budget Office have found that what is really driving the cost of medical treatment is the unnecessary treatment that people are demanding and that doctors are performing. You know, I don't.
We've got it. On the other hand, I got it loud and clear. On the other hand, there's, what, 50 million or something uninsured here, also sitting on the scales. Steve, thanks for your call. Let me get one more here. Larry, Columbia, South Carolina. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for always a great show.
Thank you.
I just did not want us to miss the obvious point, Tom. This is a moral and an ethical issue. Do we care for the sick in this country or not? And we can get lost, I think, in debating what can we legally do and what can't we do.
A moral and ethical issue, and what, you're afraid that if this reform goes down, we'll leave those 50 million uninsured? Is that what you're looking at, Larry?
Exactly, and that's my fear with the way the question is going now. People say, don't intrude on my individual rights, don't make me buy insurance, but they miss the obvious fact. Blue Cross, Magellan, Cigna, all the insurance companies are every day intruding on our individual health care decisions. I just wish people would wake up and see the larger picture.
Larry, I appreciate your call. David Cutler, you were, again, involved in designing this plan. Did you see that vision of almost universal coverage, you know, teetering here yesterday as these tough questions came?
I did see that. And the logic, if you follow through the logic of what the more conservative members of the courts were saying, it was that if you think there's a problem here, it's basically the government's creation, that the government said
has made a problem.
Has made the problem, and therefore why should we give the government the tools to fix the problem that they made of their own? So those are the issues about the hospitals caring for people and the law that says they have to if they're in an emergency, the rules about insurance companies not turning people away. From an economic point of view, that argument is exactly backwards. That is, these are markets that do not work well. And what the government is trying to do is come in and correct them. To say that it's the government creating them is really just counter to the way it's known to be economically.
There's a moral issue, an ethical issue, also an exercise of power, and that exercise very much in the sights of justices yesterday. David Cutler of Harvard University, please stand by. Jeffrey Rosen at George Washington. Kurt Lash at the University of Illinois. We're talking about health care and the Constitution. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about health care and the Constitution on the final day of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court on the fate of the Obama health care reforms. Kurt Lash is with us, professor of law at the University of Illinois. Jeffrey Rosen from George Washington University joins us from Washington, legal affairs editor at the New Republic. David Cutler is here, professor of applied economics at Harvard University. He was senior health care advisor to the Obama 08 campaign and helped design the legislation that's before the high court right now. You can join us. What do you think? Would the mandate mean a new relationship between government and citizen? Is it so different from Social Security, Medicare? And will we have a 5-4 party line vote on this by the court? Is that good? Is that bad? Is that inevitable here? Are you wondering if this health care reform is toast? And what then if it is? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here are lots of activity outside the court yesterday, pro and con. Here's Gail Gorham of New Hampshire in Washington to protest against the health care mandate, talking with NPR.
I don't like the government taking over that much of you know, they're just taking over everything. It's really supposed to be the people's choice.
And here's Courtney Everett from Chicago outside the court yesterday on the other side.
For my own children, I hope that they never have to look, struggle, you know, really worry about where they can get their medication from. And I know that Obamacare will take care of that for them.
And inside the court yesterday, an absolutely packed gallery, an electric atmosphere. And here's a little exchange between Chief Justice John Roberts pressing again Solicitor General Donald Verrilli on the uniqueness of the healthcare market, arguing that other markets might be similar.
The same, it seems to me, would be true, say, for the market in emergency services, police, fire, ambulance, roadside assistance, whatever. You don't know when you're going to need it. You're not sure that you will.
I think the fundamental difference, Mr. Chief Justice, is that that's not an issue of market regulation. This is an issue of market regulation.
Market regulation. Jeffrey Rosen, can you explain for us what the Solicitor General is getting at there?
I think that he means, once again, that the market already exists.
Mm-hmm. It's just there.
It's not creating it. Mm-hmm. And then back to that distinction between the creating and regulating the market. If I could at this point, I was struck by Steve's notion that the mandate changed the relationship between the citizen and the government, which Justice Kennedy obviously was focused on as well.
Our caller's suggestion, yes.
Yeah. But, of course, several of the liberal justices, Justice Breyer and Chief among them, stressed that this mandate changed the relationship of the citizens to the government far less than other alternative policies that the conservatives conceded were constitutional. They said that a single-payer system would have satisfied the Commerce Clause because mm-hmm. the market already existed. They said that tax incentives to reward people who'd purchased health insurance would be fine. So it is, you can call it an irony or a peculiarity of the way the case is being argued, that the conservatives are endorsing the constitutionality of systems that would change the relationship of the citizens to the government far more dramatically than the system that they're questioning.
Justice Breyer, I think, Professor Lash, saying it's kind of ironic that we're going so hard after this when there's an effort to keep the market engaged in this particular form of health care reform.
Right, that you know, this is an effort to try to rationalize the market, and we should be in favor of things that that keep the market going rather than the government simply, you know, doing the single payer and taking over healthcare altogether. But I think what's troubling the conservative justices, and I think really Justice Kennedy is making a profound point that I'm pretty sure is going to be the linchpin of his decision, is that what he means when he talks about changing the relationship of the individual to the government, which he believes is occurring. I mean, he stated that as his belief early in the oral argument. the reason he's taking that position is expanded upon later on when he says, well, for example, in tort law, individuals do not ordinarily have a duty to act or a duty to rescue. And so the way he's conceptualizing this case is that the government is imposing a duty upon individuals to enter the market. I think that is his conception of the case, to enter the market and to assist the government in its efforts to make broader policy changes in health insurance and the healthcare market in general. And to Justice Kennedy, that is a profound difference to the longstanding programs that do regulate people once they are already in the market, or payroll taxes on the basis of Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy believes that that move is extraordinary and requires, and the way Kennedy puts it, it requires a heavy burden of justification for the government to justify that kind of move. That is very freighted language. That term, heavy burden of justification, comes from mm-hmm. Loving against Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It's used by Justice Kennedy as part of the plurality opinion in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And it's the language that Kennedy has used in the past, or associated himself in the past, in situations where the government is doing something extraordinary in terms of intruding upon people's otherwise protected autonomy. So it gives you real insight into why Kennedy thinks that this really is changing the relationship, or the nature of the relationship, between the individual and the government. And he's viewing this through the lens of individual liberty.
Kurt Lash, let me ask you just on that point then. How is it, and maybe it's the market element here, but take Social Security. Everybody mm-hmm. pays into that because everybody will retire. In the same, you could see a parallel there between retirement and human health. Eventually we all retire. Eventually we all, one way or another, have health needs, health care needs. Is the difference here that citizens will be directed to buy commercial insurance, and therefore that's the distinction?
Well, again, we're trying to understand where Justice Kennedy, or how Justice Kennedy, is conceptualizing the case. And I think where Justice Kennedy would probably come out on this is that when it comes to Social Security or payroll taxes or other similar forms of government programs that rely upon mm-hmm. payroll taxes, you're dealing with people who are in a market, who are in a labor market. And so you're dealing with funded programs or regulations or constraints upon what people can or cannot do, or even requirements of what people can and cannot do, that are imposed upon an individual once they voluntarily enter into that market.
Because they take a job as opposed to sitting home or walking around the block.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Solicitor General Varelli knew that this was going to be a key distinction, a key concept in the case. And that's why it was so important to his argument throughout the day to repeat over and over again,
mm-hmm.
we are not forcing people into the market. We are instead simply regulating people who are already in the market. And then that would allow him to draw those analogies.
He's saying they're born into the market by being human.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Well, that's Jeffrey Rosen, how do you see then Kennedy, who, I mean, at the end of everything yesterday, people were saying, well, it's either Kennedy or Chief Justice John Roberts, who may be the vote or votes that if this is going to be saved, they would save it, or rejected, they would reject it. How does this, here's one leg of Kennedy's comments yesterday, and the other is where he said this looks like a unique market. Which had more gravity to your ear, Jeffrey Rosen?
Well, I think Kurt makes an extremely thoughtful point when he reminds us that for Kennedy, it seems like there's some individual liberty or autonomy interest being threatened, and that's why the government needs to meet a heavy burden of justification. But the truth is, and this is sort of the elephant in the room that wasn't mentioned at the case, the same autonomy interest would prevent states from passing healthcare mandates. And indeed, many of the challengers of the law believe that neither the states nor the federal government could force us to buy broccoli or gym memberships or healthcare. There were some interesting briefs filed in the lower courts trying to appeal to Kennedy on this and saying that really what the mandate did was violate the right to autonomy recognized in a case none other than Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, which Kennedy wrote. At the heart of liberty is the right to define your own conception of meaning in the universe, the mystery of human life, Kennedy wrote. Scalia called this the sweet mystery of life passage. But I think Kurt might be right that Kennedy, although I don't think he'll come out and say so, really does believe that neither the states nor the federal government can interfere with our autonomy. On the other hand, as you suggest, he did say it was unique, and in cases when he believes that the commerce power is actually at stake, he's been more deferential than the other conservatives and has been willing to give Congress a little more leeway. So he'll be torn, as he is in so many cases, between these two very powerful competing impulses, and trying to predict which way he comes out, as all of us know from watching him over the years, is a hazardous enterprise.
Yeah, the whole thing hazardous trying to predict, though we will take a stab at that. Let's hear from our listeners, Troy in Iowa City. Troy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is could the government mandate that I carry a gun because I might be attacked? And my other comment is if I have no money, no assets, how can I buy health insurance, which is mandated for me to buy? I have no money. I have no job. How can the government make me buy something I can't afford because I have nothing?
I think we've got answers maybe on both of those. I mean, first on the gun question, Jeffrey Rosen, take us back. Wasn't there a time when the U.S. government required American citizens to buy guns?
There was indeed, and the liberal constitutional historians who wanted the Supreme Court to be rather deferential in the gun cases that it decided a few years ago stressed that at the time of the framing, people had to buy guns as a condition of citizenship.
You're talking back at the framing of the Constitution, back in the early days of the Republic.
Absolutely, and the framers also believed that you could be conscripted into the army as well as or into the militia to be forced to carry guns. So these are all cited as examples of things that the government can do to require you to provide for the common defense and the common welfare.
David Cutler, a lot of people are listening, and you know it's a big bill. People don't know all the details. You hear Troy's question: if I have no money, how am I supposed to follow a mandate? What would the law prescribe in that case?
The answer in this case is the law says if you have no money, you'd get it for free. So, and then as people get more income, the amount of the subsidy that they would get from the government would decline and their own contributions would increase.
So this is acknowledged in the law up to twice the poverty level or three times or something.
Actually, up to four times the poverty
level. Four times you'd be subsidized. So it's really the full mandate to buy at full price is only when you've got the resources to do it and you just aren't.
That's correct. And Congress had a very lengthy debate about exactly what level was affordable for people at different levels of income and therefore how much money it had to provide by way of subsidy and the whole part of it.
So that's in the legislation. Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? And
okay. Very well, thanks.
Okay. Well, I guess the court is like this and part of their interpretation. And I'm going to have my own interpretation, and everybody else would have the same interpretation, too. If they turn down this, turn back this law, then I should be able to go and call GEICO or whatever insurance agency that I have and say they cannot mandate me to have car insurance. What I'll do is if I get in an accident, I'll just wait until, like you said, they say come into the emergency room. What I'll do, I'll wait till I get to the accident, and I'll give you an IOU. So what you do, and I'll pay $10 or $5 a month until your medical bills are paid for.
Calvin, we've got it. You're going to call GEICO after the car is wrecked or just hand an IOU over to the wrecking service or the hospital. I appreciate your call. We're talking very much. We'll look at that. We're talking about the Supreme Court and health care reform. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kurt Lash, you hear the suggestion of our caller from Sumter say, hey, you know, just call the insurance company after. Same argument that we heard as before the court yesterday.
That's right, and it goes to the idea of in two different directions. If they're allowed to pass this act, what else will they be allowed to require us to purchase? As the previous caller asked, would it require the purchase of a gun? On the other hand, if they strike this down, what else can we not be required to do? Would it give us some type of libertarian right not to have to purchase car insurance? There are different answers to that, and I think some of those came out in the oral argument yesterday. Again, if you conceive of the case as one turning on the distinction of whether or not one has entered a market or one is already in a market, then the way you would distinguish the car insurance hypothetical is that if you choose to engage in the activity of driving a car, then the government can impose certain requirements and certain safety requirements and certain cost-shifting requirements. But you're not required to drive a car at all. There's no forced activity involved in that insurance requirement. So that would be one distinction. And the other distinction would be that even if we conceive of car insurance as some type of mandated activity, insurance has been primarily, or that type of car insurance and that type of regulation is commonly associated with the power of the states to regulate affairs within their borders. And that brings in the federalism question. Mm-hmm. In other words, a part of what this case is about is that, is this a power not given into the hands of the federal government, but instead is reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people, for example, car insurance. Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Rosen, here's a comment from listener Jim. He says, as Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over. He says, oral arguments and questions often have no bearing on the decision. The Supremes really asked tough questions on the Voting Rights Act and ruled in favor of it. The conservative federal circuit courts asked tough questions about the Affordable Health Care Act and upheld it. Jim writes, let's just calm down and let the process run the course. But what kind of wind did you hear blowing yesterday, Jeffrey?
Well, the caller is absolutely right, and we shouldn't read too much into oral argument. And the instant commentary that Obamacare is dead, as several pundits said, seems simplistic. On the other hand, the fact is that conventional wisdom before the argument had been that there would be several conservative votes to uphold, in particular Justice Scalia, who's embraced a broad vision of Congress's commerce power as recently as 2004, and he certainly didn't seem to be having much of it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And Justice Alito seemed skeptical, too. And I was thinking a little more about the question you just posed about which way would Kennedy choose given these two conflicting impulses that he has, mm-hmm. autonomy on the one hand and deference to commerce on the other. The truth is when Kennedy feels that the individual is being coerced by the state, he tends to side with the individual. He's done that in cases involving gay rights and involving religious liberty. He thinks it's he has a very earnest vision of liberty, which he's willing to enforce quite aggressively. So I think if he's persuaded that that's the right framework for the case, then he might well rule against it. And Chief Justice Roberts, who sees this as the cornerstone of his legacy, might well provide the sixth vote to uphold the mandate. But if all the other conservatives are against it, then he might indeed strike it down. So beyond that, we can't know, but except to say that it looks close, and I wouldn't be betting on either side at the moment.
Kurt Lash, we've just got a half a minute here, but by that analysis, it seems to lean toward rejection.
Well, I agree with Jeff that a lot of this is going to turn. It will turn on Justice Kennedy's vote. And just to tie together some strains of thought that we've talked about today, mm-hmm. I think he does see it as involving individual liberty, and so it's going to require a special justification from the government. His final comments suggest that he might believe that there's something uniquely compelling about this particular situation. But one final aspect of Justice Kennedy's jurisprudence is that even if it's important, the government has to be careful how it addresses that important issue, and he might find that this law is overbroad.
Kurt Lash at the University of Illinois, thank you very much for being with us today from Urbana, Illinois. Kurt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen at George Washington University, it's always great to have you. Thank you, Jeffrey, for being here.
It's a pleasure to talk.
And David Cutler of Harvard, do you have hope here, David? Do you think your plan may still make it through the high court?
I keep up the hope.
Up the hope. We're listening closely. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.